Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see so many of you still here. So many of you came back. I'm so grateful. Let's do this. Let's take a moment, maybe more than a moment. You know, I hate it when they tell me we're going to take a moment and then they don't tell you how long the moment's going to be. So then you keep looking up to see if you're done with the moment yet. So we're going to take today about 2 minutes. So that's going to feel like a longer moment to you, just so you know you didn't miss the cue, okay? It's gonna happen. I'll call you back with the same prayer. And if you know the prayer by now, it's not that I don't know other prayers, it's that this one opens my mind for thinking and creativity every single time I say it. So we'll have 2 minutes of silence and then join me in the prayer if you've known it by now. As you are in the silence today, once again, feel your breath. Feel how it comes from the very bottoms of your feet all the way up. When you breathe in, give thanks. And when you breathe out, give thanks. Thanks, and thanks. Take a minute, 2 minutes. Lively God, take our minds and think through them. Take our hands and work through them. Take our hearts and set them on fire. Amen. So I mentioned 2 minutes today because we all have 2 minutes, right? 2 minutes. When I ask you for 2 minutes, that doesn't seem like a long time. When you sit for 2 minutes and breathe in thanks and breathe out thanks, you have time to thank for quite a bit, right? There's time. I've noticed in the different sessions that I was sitting and listening on this week that Holden seems to have had some kind of reasoning for bringing this particular teaching faculty together. Yesterday afternoon in this room, I heard about mindfulness and policing. I've listened to David talk about his work in doing improv. And I'm here to say, if you've heard those things too, you've heard resonances between these sessions.
Right,
exactly. All of us are working on similar ideas, which is how do we bring people into their full humanity? One of the great Christian theologians is quoted over and over again as saying, the glory of God is humanity fully alive. So when Richard's talking about how do we work on the violence problem in our country by caring for our policemen, what is he talking about? Helping police become more fully alive. And when David's making room for improv in our lives, what is he helping you do? Find parts of yourself you didn't know you had and help you become fully alive. There is something deeply faithful, deeply worshipful, deeply written into the human divine experience about allowing ourselves to become fully alive. And those 2 minutes that you just took are just a tiny part of that. You can do that anytime. Anywhere, and when you emerge from the 2 minutes, you're just this much more multidimensional. You're just this much more fully alive. So I invite you to lots of 2 minutes during the rest of your time here at Holden, and maybe that's a pattern you'll sustain thereafter. We ended yesterday about here, and I'm going to pick up here, because where we're going to go today is beyond ourselves and into the imagination of God. No little thing. Hope you brought coffee. It's a stimulating journey. I start with people, and I've said this a couple of times, I start talking about ourselves because I think once we recognize that in ourselves we have space, in ourselves we have some fluidity and movement, in ourselves we have various parts, in ourselves, there's an ongoing conversation. If you can experience these things about yourself, then it leaves you open to wonder about the heart and the mind of God we use to describe the heart and the mind of God, and what those words and images do as they help shape us, as they help shape our communities, as they help shape the world we live in. The goal of today's session is to maybe help us create expansive language. And language does stuff. Words do stuff. When your mom says, do your homework, those are words, right? Do they make you do something? Sometimes, right? Yes, yes. Good, thank you for being Exhibit A. Words do stuff, all right? Words do stuff. Words are powerful. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. The words we use to talk about the God we serve have ramifications for what's in our own hearts and souls, for what our faith communities do or don't do, and do for better or do for worse, or don't do for better or worse, and how that language gets deployed by all kinds of speakers and all kinds of powers in the world we live in. So it's critical, I think, as people who call ourselves by some of the names of God, that we learn to use our language in life-giving ways, in holy ways, in divinely inspired ways, in living water ways, and not in ways that abuse and destroy. If there's an underlying curriculum in this week's sessions, that's it. I talked a little bit yesterday, or through the sessions, about why it is that we need to talk about multiplicity and multiple selves and the multiplicity of God. Why do we need that? We need that especially now, because we will see, hear, and do more things, visit more places, interact with more people, encounter more new discoveries than any generation before us. This abundance, we talked about abundance on Monday, this abundance brings opportunity for learning and growth and creativity, but it also brings anxiety, fear, stress, conflict, and confusion. If I took Mr. Holden Village over here and had him hold out his arms and just started throwing apples into his arms, he'd catch about the first 10, right? And then about the first 15, he'd be kind of worried, right? Like, And if I gave you 20 more, you'd be even more. This is what it's like to live in our culture right now. Stuff coming in, like incoming apples, all the time. How do we hold it? How do we use it? So we need ourselves in order to be resourceful and creative, to be compassionate and resilient with ourselves as well as others, to engage conflict. We talked a little bit about conflict yesterday. Calm, clarity, and hope to heal from the necessary trauma and loss that life will bring. Notice I say necessary trauma and loss. Mm-hmm. You hear the word trauma and you think immediately of trauma centers or great catastrophic earthquakes and cataclysms. Trauma is part of what it means to be human, right? You would be an unusual person, grown and living your whole life in a little Ziploc bag, if you didn't experience at some point trauma in your life. It's there. And loss is continual. This little guy's already losing, right? That's why he looks so pensive. It's like, where's the wound? Everything was fine, right? Loss begins right away. Loss begins with birth. To heal from necessary trauma and loss that life will bring, to imagine bold new solutions to big challenges. Heaven knows we have them in our culture right now and in our world. And to have what John Chrysostom calls 1,000 eyes with which to apprehend our world as the stage and area for God's new things. When you experience yourselves, it's easier to see the multiple ways that God moves in the world. So that's what that's about. I ended yesterday with this slide, I think. The discovery that multiplicity isn't a 21st century invention. It's been with us since the beginning. Bonhoeffer notices it as a way that he's coping with prison life and the onslaught of the war and the bombs. What deliverance it is, he says, to be able to think and thereby remain multidimensional. I made it a rule here in the prison camp, he says, simply to tell people who are trembling under an air raid that it would be much worse for a small town. I'm not sure that part works very well. We have to get people out of their one-track minds. That is a kind of preparation for faith, or something that makes faith possible. Although really, it's only faith itself that can make possible a multi-dimensional life. So as we move into thinking about God, I want you to think about the interplay between faith and a multiplicity. A multiplicity of view, a multiplicity of mind, a multiplicity of self, a multiplicity of God. Faith makes it possible for us to think in this way, right? We don't have to see everything. We don't have to know everything. That's the essence of faith. We don't know, we have faith. But also, this multiplicity helps us increase or see our faith in bigger ways. Go with me now on a little bit of a journey. I'm gonna start this session, or spend some time this session, by giving you, just helping you to think about some new language, okay? Some language for God. And to do a little bit of genealogy of some of that language. Where did the language we use, where did that come from? Why do we use it? Is that the language we intend? Is that the language that will do the work right now that we want to do? So we're gonna spend a little time talking about language for God. We're going to spend a good chunk, maybe the last 20-25 minutes of this session. I want you to be able to tell some of your own God stories to one another. But we'll give you some preparation and some priming for that. But just in case you think there's a lot of words on that screen or a lot of words coming out of this mouth, that's going to change up pretty soon. A lot of what I am going to share with you today comes from a book. I've mentioned this book before, by Laurel Schneider. Laurel was for a while a theologian at Chicago Theological Seminary, and now she's at Vanderbilt Divinity School. She is a theologian that blends sort of postmodern work with feminist work, with some of the African American or liberation theologies, to help us imagine a theology for and about this time, this place. A theology that is kind of responsive and conversational with what's going on in human experience, in the world right now, in the lives of real people. Her worry all the time is that our theological language has gotten very disconnected from people's lives, people's experiences, and therefore isn't a resource like we need it to be to help us navigate ourselves and to navigate the world. So Laurel's big project is always, how can I make this more lively? How can I make this more about life? The word she uses to talk about that is not a word that's helpful. She calls it ontic. Those of you who have been to divinity school, you know what ontic means, right? Come on, Marcus. So, ontic just means, ontic just means it's about being, right? Ontology is the word we all learned when we first got there. O-N-T-O-L-O-G-I. And what it means, it's just a fancy word for being. But not being as nothing, being as life. Okay? Being as life. If I told you for those 2 minutes this morning that you had to hold your breath, right? That would be disturbing. Why? Why does that make you anxious? I'm going to say, like, hold your breath for 2 minutes. Now hold it for 5 minutes. Now hold your breath till lunchtime. What would happen? Yeah. You couldn't do it, right? You couldn't do it. That's being. That's the life force. So anytime you hear that word ontic, you might see it up on the screen in a minute. I just want you to think life force being. What Laurel's trying to get us to do is think about God as experienced and God as emerging all the time in us. Not away, gone, far away, done God's work, sitting back, looking at us, mess it up with folded arms, right? Not that God. But the God that is emerging in the life force all the time. So that's what this is all about. Now the part that is interesting to me, And the piece about when we start teaching about God that is concerning to me is that we are the people who often use the word monotheism to describe what we are about, right? You know that word, monotheism? Anybody know what that word means?
One God.
Right. That's how we describe it, one God. I'm not sure that's what it means. That's how we've been describing it. That's how the word has gotten deployed over time. Laurel, in her writing, wants to contrast what she calls the logic of the one, and the logic of multiplicity, or the logic of multiple. To say, I think we've gotten one, this notion of one, I think we've shrunk it. I think we've gotten it slightly a kilter. So that when we now think about monotheism, what comes to our minds too often, she thinks, is God is this, and not 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 this. And God's people, then, are these people, and not these people, and not these people, and not these people, and not these people. And God's truth is this, and not this, or this, or this, or this, or this. So she wants us to think differently about this word one. And she wants us to think about one as a spacious concept and not as a single sort of monolith of sameness. Laurel is wanting, in the culture we live in, to make room for difference. If you've ever been part of a Christian community, you know that one of the things we struggle with in Christian community is difference. I don't mean just we have different eye color or different hair color. I went to St. Olaf College when I didn't have an S-O-N at the end of my last name. And I had to learn what it meant to stand out in the crowd. The St. Olaf Christmas concert was televised the first year that I was at, for the very first time when I was a student there. And I was the person with the dark hair in the back of the choir. I don't mean that kind of difference. I mean difference. Christian communities often have conflicts that just break their hearts because difference is so hard for us to navigate. Difference, not politeness, difference. Difference is hard for us to navigate. Christian communities often find that our social location, our economic status, our race, our ethnicity tends to be more alike in our communities than different. We struggle with difference. And so Laurel is saying, if Christianity is going to live and thrive, if God's going to do what God can do in the world, we have to develop a new way of thinking about difference. And she wants us to reinterpret monotheism as part of that. She says, whatever you hold most deeply, that's the kind of thinking that resonates through all your other thoughts and actions. And we have this deep, but often unexamined notion about God as one. So I want you to think about oneness today and see if you can find space in your one. Does this make sense? Okay. She says the logic of one is not wrong, except ironically when it is taken to be the whole story. It's not false, but it's incomplete. The logic of the one and the concept of God that falls within it is simply not one. There's always less and more, she says, to the story. And she uses as one of her chapter headings this little, this verse from Exodus that many of us have thought about over the years and wondered about. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And then what's the rest of that verse? Anyone know? You shall have no other gods. Okay, here's the verse that you never get to, right? Or here's the word you never get to. What? You have shown no other gods what?
Before
me. What does that mean? Right? It's not to say there's not a lot out there, right?
we can talk about this covenant relationship we have with the one he calls me. We can talk about that. That's a relationship, right? That's a relationship. The fact that the world is full and that God isn't just one flat thing, that's been in our tradition for a very long time. So just remember that as we play. Just a little tour and some really bad PowerPoint work here. Sorry about how I wished Tertullian over there. He actually is much longer than that. He's not a short white man. I want to talk a little bit about the strands of multiplicity, even in our own theological tradition. So, y'all right, monotheism is a term that we use to talk about a religion in which the members express belief in the existence and venerate only one high God. There's a different word, and Bible scholars use it, you don't hear it in many other places, called monolatry, different than idolatry, right? Monolatry in the Hebrew Bible, and that's the practice of worshiping one God. So there's a difference, right, between monotheism, this idea that there's one God high, and the idea that we worship one, or relate to one, and practice with one. It's also important to know that this word monotheism doesn't appear in this book, right? It's not in the Bible, monotheism. It's a word that started appearing about the 17th century after the word polytheism came about, right? And who do you think is talking about monotheism and polytheism? Who's interested in that kind of stuff?
People who want power.
People who are interested in making categories, right? Yeah. And picking fights. Both of those things. So these came out of theological arguments. Neither one of them is very good at talking about or describing or expressing divinity, holiness. Neither one of them are very good at that. And the people that use these terms most often from the 1600s up until now, social scientists, people who do studies, the people in my building who study anthropology and sociology of religion, they're always trying to say, well, that group of people, it looks like they're worshiping many gods. This kind of people, this people is worshiping one God. They're not people on the inside of the circle. They're people on the outside of the circle telling you what it is you're doing. I want you to think about what use these words have been put to as argument or as category. Different ways of othering, right? Different ways of saying, well, you do this. Not really about one's experience of divinity, of God. Now there were people from the beginning who were thinking about the multiplicity of God. And they weren't saying, oh, gods are many. Multiplicity doesn't mean many instead of one. Multiplicity is about the abundance within, okay? The abundance within is an old concept that came out of, we talked about this a little bit the other day, that came out of the African continent from the African theologians, of which Tertullian was one. And this is Tertullian's early model of the Trinity down here, right? Those of, we have lots of Latin speakers in the room, right? Lots of you. So this is just the Father, the Spirit, the Son. These are God. These aren't each other. It's a complicated way that already, look at the dates on Tertullian. He's been around a while. Already people were understanding, we have a problem talking about one God. What's the problem? What's the problem? God does, and how did they know that in the second century? Yeah. They've got a Jesus problem, right? Here's this guy walking around, and this guy is claiming, right, to be the Messiah. This God is claiming to be the Son of God. That messes up the mono in monotheism, right? What are we going to do with that? So Tertullian is here to try to deal with a big question. And the question is, we have an incarnation. We have an incarnation. Which means what? The word incarnation is what? God in flesh. God in flesh. And then the odd thing was, even when they killed the flesh, it kept
the God thing kept coming back, right? So there was a resurrection, and then there was a Pentecost. Tomorrow we're going to do the Pentecost story because that's my favorite multiplicity story, I think. God kept coming back. So the Trinity is an early way that the Christians are trying to figure out how to say who our God is. Our God is three. They decide three in one. And I would say now we'd probably say many more than that. But three in one. What happened to the concept of the Trinity? I mean, it's kind of under there, right? You've had a children's sermon sometime where somebody's brought in ice and water and what's the other thing?
Steam.
Steam, right. But so we still kind of talk about the Trinity. More as an interesting old relic or artifact, I think, than as a living reality. Yeah. I don't know that we know what to do with it. I'm going to suggest we should be doing a whole lot more with it. What happened to it? Why isn't this the way Christians always think about their God? A, because it's complicated. Something more, I'm guessing, happened, and I think what happened was Constantine. Mm-hmm. Right? You're gonna pull together a whole empire under a religion, right? Constantine saw something great about Christianity. It was already in all of the areas that he wanted to accumulate into one empire, right? If we could have one religion and one empire, and guess what? We don't have three emperors. We only have
one.
Right. So under Constantine's reign, you heard much, much less about the Trinity, and theologians wrote much, much more about the one. Here are some quotes to know that there were outliers. Tertullian was out there, Augustine was out there. That the idea of the Trinity that is refracted through African philosophy, each member of the Trinity is because they are, because they are, each belongs, and therefore is. I'm going to move along to now. Has anybody been to the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City? You've been there? You recognize this? We're carved into it. It's hard to see everything in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine because it's just hard, all over the place. Trying to make this point that the divine is multiple, right? All kinds of people make an appearance in that cathedral. So along the sort of carving along one of the altar rails, there have been, before this slide, a succession of sort of traditional saints. And then you see Gandhi, and then you see Abraham Lincoln. They're all there. So how is it that we begin to image what God is doing in the world? I want us to think about what it would mean for all of us to become theologians. I would say a huge problem in the church today is that we have this divide. People like Laurel here, they teach at universities and they write books. Most Christians live elsewhere. Oh no, there it is. Most Christians live elsewhere. I think until we empower Christians everywhere to become theologians in their spiritual lives and in their working lives and in all the rest of their lives, our ideas about God are going to continue to calcify. And they're going to continue to separate us. And they're going to continue to divide us. And they're going to continue to become more and more and more irrelevant. God sightings have to come from everywhere, or what we're citing is not God. So, and Laurel kind of mentions that. Everything we think or say or teach or proclaim or believe or catechize is God. Right? The minute we say it, the minute we encapsulate it in a word, or we encapsulate it in a ritual or in a story, then it's not God, because God's more than that. She likes to call God the deep. Her favorite language for talking about God is the deep, and by that she means the waters of creation, right? She likes to use the language of fluidity and water to talk about who God is, so she talks about the deep. So she would say, everything we think or say or teach or proclaim or believe or catechize is not God, not the deep. not multiplicity, not enough. Everything is not enough. So we need all of us to do this. We should use caution when we say anything direct or descriptive about God. So our Jewish brothers and sisters don't. That's why my Muslim brothers and sisters say 99 names, but don't innovate. You don't get to have more names that aren't in the book, right? 99, but no more. Because they understand the caution, they understand the what's at stake when we start talking about God, who God is. And at the same time, she says, here's the tension, we must say something specific and fleshy. And why? Because of Jesus. Because we have an incarnation, because we have an incarnate deity who's embodied in our stories. And so she says, God comes. Divinity responds and shifts into shape, born under stars of longing, washed in rivers of connection, touching a wounded body here, a shredded heart there, walks, thirsts, and learns, rises up, is broken like bread, slips through the open door of death, returns. She's describing, she's a very poetic writing style, she's describing the places in our existence where God emerges, where God's visible, where God's moving, where God's seen. Here's the role of theologians, and this is why I think you are them, and you need to embody your profession fully. Throughout history, theology and theologians are always trying to articulate understandings of the divine that are plausible, making contact with the world, linking the profundity of the Christian symbols to the meaning and structures of lived experiences and cultures. If theology is distant from the world, then it's elite and it's irrelevant. That's happened. Places like I work, they've done that to you. Don't let that happen. Theology that pretends a distance from prayer is fooling itself. And so the question of theology, which is our question today, is how does God come to us now? And if you say, gee, I don't know, I'm not sure, a friend of Laurel's, Catherine Keller, says uncertainty is theology's greatest opportunity. If we don't know, if we're not sure, that's where to look. So, do you recognize these people? You're the theologians. So, the task of theology is to take stock of the God dimension in the lifetime and circumstances in which we find ourselves. I'm going to give you an assignment of that nature in just a minute, but do you see the shift from doctrine? Here's the way, we're going to memorize it. Those are fine patterns. I'm not here to destroy 2,000 years of theology. That would be sort of silly. I have a lot of those books on my shelf, and I love them. They're the knitting pattern, right? They're the knitting pattern. But those of you who knit a lot know that after a while, the pattern, you're going to have to adapt it, right? You have to grow it. You have to change the color. You have to do something to make the thing fit you, to make the thing fit. So all the theology we read, the creeds that we say, the liturgies that we perform, those are beautiful. They're patterns, they're containers, they grow things. They're not God. Do you see the difference? I hope I'm not saying anything. Y'all are Lutherans. Luther said this stuff a long time ago. So it's not just me. What I want to say to you is those are beautiful containers, and now the life starts. Now the work starts. Now you have eyes, and we go out and see and name and talk about how we see God moving in the world. And the more of us doing that, the better. The more places we do it, the better. Scripture for you. I'll let you read the other sidebar on your own. But I want you to know this is already there. I'm not making this up. This is already there. I love the passages. They're in Matthew, and very different ones are in Luke, about the kingdom of God, or the kingdom of heaven. And it's clear that the gospel writer, both in Matthew and in Luke, accumulating these parables that Jesus tells, doesn't present to you just one. The gospel writer doesn't say, Jesus said a lot of stuff, here's the one to remember. Memorize this. the point and the structure of both these passages in Matthew and in Luke. They're full of ands, or agains. Matthew likes the word again. Luke likes the word and. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, Matthew writes, which someone found and hid, and then in joy he goes and sells all he has and he buys the field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all he had and bought it. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was thrown into the sea and caught fish of every kind. When it was full, they drew it ashore, sat down and put the good into baskets and threw out the bad. He said to them, every scribe who's been trained for the kingdom of heaven, that's you, by the way, is like a master of a household who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old, meaning what? You can't just regurgitate the old, right? What is new and what is old, you gotta have both. You gotta have both. You gotta be looking, you gotta be creating new images, new places, new sightings of God all the time. Luke, similarly, what is the kingdom like, and to what should I compare it? It's a mustard seed that somebody took and sowed in the garden. It grew and became a tree, and the birds of the air made nests in its branches. And then, again, he said, what should I compare the kingdom of God? It's like yeast that a woman took and mixed in with 3 measures of flour until all of its leaven. What do you notice about all those images? What comes to mind when you see them?
The idea of more.
More, right? More, more, more. You can't read one of these passages without just letting your soul expand a little bit, right? This, and this, and this, and this. It's generous, right? It's generous for people like us who are used to wanting one answer to things. This, and this, and this, and this. What else do you notice?
It's in the everyday things you might encounter, experience.
Exactly, exactly. We're not talking about long-winded propositions with 5-syllable words, right? These are pearls and yeast and fish and seeds. These are things that are all around us. They're things that have multiple meanings in them. A seed can be all sorts of things, so can a fish. There's some bad ones and some good ones, apparently. But the fact is, these aren't intellectual creations. They're experiences, right? Look at all the verbs in here. These are activities. These are active things. Oh my gosh, it's getting late. These are active. These are experiences that happen to us in the midst of life, and we're involved in them. We're doing them. We're doing them. All right, so you've got the point. A Rilke poem. You guys all know Rilke. You probably read a lot about that Holden Village. With all its eyes, the animal world holds open. Not open. Only our eyes are as if inverted and set all around it like traps at its portals to freedom. What's outside, we only know from the animal's countenance. For almost from the first, we take a child, there he is, and twist him round and force him to gaze backwards and take instruction. Not the open that lies so deep in the animal's face. I think what Rook is trying to say is, structure's important, but there's also an ability that we share with creatures to look at what lies before us as open, as possibility, as plenty, as abundance, as multiple. And in those instances, we find God. So, I told you all that you are theologians. I want you to practice. One of the best ways, I think, that you can practice your own theological imagination of the multiplicity of God is by doing a little storytelling, okay? So just in the time that is remaining, which is not enough, gosh, what is the hour going to be? It's God, after all, it's a good time. I want you to take a minute, find a partner or two, no more than two, probably triads, trinities work best for this, and do a little storytelling. I want you to think about a time when you experienced in your life an opening. Some of the theologians say the times in which life is leaving us or life is entering the world, those are times that make us wonder about the presence of the all-living God. So maybe you're thinking about a birth, a death, a loss, an opening, an uncertainty, a moment of wonder, a moment when it was clear that something you thought you understood, you didn't understand at all. I want you just to tell a short story, no more than just a minute long story, a minute story. See if you can do that. A minute story to each other about an opening, and ask your partner to help you see the presence of God in it. One of you is a teller, one of you is a witness. Do you understand? Do you understand? One of you is a teller, one of you is a witness. Sometimes it takes a witness to say, God could enter in that space. Is that clear what I'm asking you to do? Is it frightening or strange? Yes? Good. God is not comfortable. We'll get to that tomorrow, right? Tomorrow we're going to talk a lot about what does it mean that God is multiple? What does that do to us? What does that do with us? What does that do for us? What does that do to nationalism? What does that do to racism? What does that do to some of the things that are holding us back as people of God together? Okay? But for now, just tell a little story about an open place in your life, a place you don't have it figured out, a place that's not all put together. Does this make sense? I'll call you back at the end. Thank you. Come back for just a second. We don't have time to go into detail on this. I hope that you found some expansion in the sharing of stories and some new insight or a renewed old insight about some of the many aspects, some of the multiple aspects of what we call God. Laurel talks about the divine all the time because it doesn't sound like one name. I think she's not wrong about that. But I use interchangeable language to do this when I'm working with folks who come from different places. But just really quickly, were there episodes in which you were able to catch some of the aspects of God? And what were they? What kind of episodes were you talking about? I know it's hard to say your story in short, but what sorts of events were you all talking about?
Like transition events.
Transitions.
Moves and moves. And,
changes.
Changes.
Yep. Changes. Think about the aspects of God that are about change. Oddly, one of the things that we are most worried about as people is what?
Change.
What if God is change, change, change? And imagine what would happen if nothing changed. It's cool being 11, right? Do you want to spend the rest of your life being 11? Do you want to? I love this kid. Josiah, you can't drive till you're 16, though, right? Uh-huh. You want to drive?
Yes.
Okay, so, all right. So there might be one reason that you want to not be 11.
Yes.
Change. Great. Transition, change. What other kind of stories were you telling?
Our story sort of had this common theme of pain.
Pain? Absolutely. Absolutely. We're talking about a God who comes into the world through giving birth. I don't know why you'd be thinking about pain, Becky, at a time like this. Right. Again, something that we try desperately to avoid, right? What happens when people can't experience pain? Absolutely. If we're not vulnerable to pain, all sorts of terrible things actually do happen to us, right? That pain is life force. That pain is of God. Laurel talks about porosity. That's a fancy word. What does porosity mean? Right, you're porous. You take things in, right? Pain comes to us because we take things in, like viruses. Of God, of God. What else? What other kinds of experiences?
Grief.
Two of our stories were death.
Right, right, right. And in those moments of sort of being undone, mm-hmm. right, of being, of feeling that loss, those are moments, right, of understanding what love is, yeah? Mm-hmm. We don't grieve things we don't love, right?
And grief is gratitude.
Yeah. Absolutely, right. Absolutely.
And you witness the change. Like
right.
You said,
exactly.
change. All of a sudden, your life changes.
Exactly. Yeah.
I just talked about hope.
Yes. And I'm not, this is a terrible question to ask at the 95th hour here. But what hope is what for you? What is that? What does it mean to hope?
Looking forward to a fuller, healthier life.
Absolutely. And how do you know to do that? How are we built out like that?
Faith. Knowing that you're not alone, you're given strength, you're given ability, and trusting.
Yeah, exactly. So she would call that the part of the divine nature is beginning again, right? There's going to be more.
Yeah.
We can begin again. There's going to be a new. There's going to be another. There's going to be, it's very future-oriented. Future-oriented makes me say, we have to stop right now, because time is up. I'm supposed to be doing coffee, whatever that means. I'm going to be sitting in the Ark in a few minutes with a cup of coffee. If you want to continue this conversation, I'd be happy to talk about God all day. So I'll be in the Ark at 10, and hopefully maybe some of you will come back tomorrow. Thank you for your time.